I'm author and critic David Agronoff. I'm a horror and science fiction author, critic, and researcher. In this podcast, I wanted to provide in-depth interviews and panel discussions with everyone from New York Times bestselling authors to researchers, musicians, and anyone I find interesting. Welcome to Postcards from a Dying World. Welcome to Postcards from a Dying World. I am super stoked to have my special guest here today. Before I introduce him, of course, I have to do a little bit of props for my own work. The Last Night to Kill Nazis. If you hate Nazis but like vampires, I've got the novel for you. It's a vampire novel set on the last day of World War II, and it's available nationwide here in the United States at Barnes & Noble's, and it's out there. You can get it anywhere, though, from Clash Books. So just one little prop for my latest book. And I got another one coming in March, but details are coming soon. But we're here to talk about a different book. We're here to talk about Mike Carey's latest book under the name M.R. Carey, which we'll talk about that transition, I'm sure, in a little bit. Mike's new book, Infinity Gate, is absolutely one of the best reads I've had, not just of the year, but it's one of the best science fiction books I've read in a long time. And so we're going to talk about Infinity Gate. But welcome to Postcards from a Dying World. Mike Carey, it's an honor to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Thanks for inviting me on. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I have read your work since before you were a novelist. I've read your work in comics. I'm a giant Hellblazer fan, so that's where I first discovered your work from and writing the line. Did you start as a comic reader, or were you a prose guy from the beginning? What's your origins with genre?
With comics. I learned to read from comics when I was about 3 years old. There was a British comic called Wham! With an exclamation point after it, which was the brainchild of two incredible British talents, Leo Baxendale and Ken Reed. They'd become disillusioned with DC Thompson, no connection to the American DC, it's a Scottish publishing firm, and moved to a different publisher, Fleetway IPC, and they were given like free rein to do their own stuff. And at the age of three, I picked this comic up, and it just blew my mind. I can sort of remember spelling out the words on my mother's knee, literally. So I could spell words like arg with three R's. At a very young age, and it's kind of started a lifelong love affair. When I was eight, my older brother gave me a Fantastic Four annual, and it was it's the one where Reed is trapped in the negative zone, and they have to find someone to free him, and they choose Triton of the Inhumans, because the negative zone is kind of a void that's like the ocean, and that made me sort of fall in love with superhero comics. And for a long time, I sort of like devoured all the American comic books that I possibly could, not just DC and Marvel, but Dell, Ace, Gold Key, all of the smaller imprints that no longer exist. Comics were a very, very big part of my life from a very early age.
Well, it's funny how that like one storyline, like that negative zone story with Fantastic Four sticks in your memory. I know for me, it was like the whole arc of who is the Hobgoblin in
Spider-Man.
Spider-Man was one of the things that really got me into long form storytelling, because I just remember being on the edge of my seat, like who's going to be the Hobgoblin, right?
Yeah.
And, I first discovered your work. We had an amazing comic shop in my hometown in Indiana, 25th Century Five and Dime, and it was in this basement, and I would go every week to get, I was, you know, pretty religious about getting on the Tuesday release of whenever the new Hellblazer was out, you know, I'd go down to 25th, So you got to write for Hellblazer and X-Men, and you know, I'm sure, you know, what was the moment, the most pinch me moment where you were writing comics? Like, that had to be pretty amazing.
There's two, really. I mean, the moment when Alisa Quitney called me up and asked me if I wanted to write a three-part Lucifer story in Sandman continuity. That was amazing because I was a huge, huge Sandman fan. I thought then, and I still believe that, you know, Sandman created a template for extended stories, long form stories in comics that nobody had ever done before, a novelistic template. And Alan Moore was kind of moving towards it in Swamp Thing, but I think it comes to its fruition in Gaiman's work. And so being able to play in that sandbox, no pun intended, was just incredible. I was so excited, I forgot to be afraid of following in Neil's footsteps. And then some years later, when Nick Lowe called me up and asked me if I wanted to take a shot at the X-Men, in my first X-Men arc, I introduced a new villain group called the Children of the Vault. And about maybe 6 weeks after the first issue came out, someone sent me a link to a Wikipedia article on the Children of the Vault. It had become, you know, it had become canonical,
right.
And that made it kind of real in a way it hadn't been before. Because I grew up reading those stories, and then being able to tell stories, to add stories, it felt like, you know, adding rooms to a house that I lived in as a child. It was just magical.
Yeah, friend of the podcast, Desmond Reddick, who does a Canadian horror podcast called Dread Media, told me that he would have a hard time not asking you about 35 questions about your X-Men run. He specifically told me that it was one of his favorite runs for X-Men. And I'm not as huge of a comic reader. That's the thing. So I haven't read it. I've read your Hellblazer run because I loved horror comics, right? I wasn't a big superhero guy, but I loved Constantine because it felt like a horror comic. So I've always read, you know, that kind of stuff. But I do remember your Lucifer run because I was a Sandman guy as well.
Right. Yeah.
So, and, but Lucifer really took off too. So it kind of became your thing, right? Like, you were most associated with it.
Yeah, it did. And, it was very much a game changer for me, you know, career wise. I can remember meeting Karen Berger at a British con, UCAC, UKCAC, the UK Comic Art Convention. They used to have the convention would run over a weekend. And on the Friday before it started, the Society for Strip Illustrators, which is a professional body for comic creators in the UK, would have a kind of pre-meet. And Karen came to that. And I can remember chatting to her and saying, you know, I was still waiting for the big break. And she said, there is no big break. What there is, if you're lucky, is an endless chain of little breaks that eventually crests. But Lucifer, you know, getting to write Lucifer felt like a big, big, big break. And it was a privilege to, you know, to work directly with Neil on it, because he was script consultant, creative consultant on all of those early Sandman Universe titles. And he was incredibly generous with his time. We'd have long phone conversations about possible ways of taking the story and his take on the characters in the story.
Yeah, and those types of things, like when you get those opportunities, it's just like how much you can learn from just conversations with writers like that. It's just
amazing. Yeah, really.
Yeah, very cool.
He only ever said no to me twice. There were two things that two moments when he sort of stepped in, because generally speaking he let me have free rein. But there was a point where I wanted to bring in Rose Walker to tell a Rose Walker story, and he asked me not to. He said if he ever came back to Sandman, that was the story that he was going to pick up, you know, the story of her pregnancy. And the other time was when I had Lucifer talking to Death. I gave Death a line of dialogue. Lucifer says to her, "You have no claim on me." And she says, "I wouldn't have anywhere to put you anyway." And Neil said, "She can't say that. She's not like the other endless. She doesn't have a realm. You know, there isn't a realm of death like the dreaming. So that it doesn't make any sense for her to say that. So I cut that out. And I can't remember any other time when he said no.
Right.
Generally speaking, he was sort of like incredibly accepting of the stuff that I was doing, and really helpful with suggestions, and just full of just very, very supportive. When we got the monthly approved, he said to me, there are some things you can only learn by doing them. You know, you can't know from the outside what a weird mix of serendipity and of careful planning and serendipity a monthly comic book is. So this will be good for you. And I said, you can't tell me that anything in Sandman was serendipitous. Surely it was all planned from the start, because the ending is present in the beginning. And he said, yeah, the ending is present in the beginning, but you wouldn't believe how many things just happened because they happened. And that turned out to be true.
Right. Well, and so you got a lot of experience doing the long form storytelling through comics, but it was your Felix Caster books where you really broke out and did prose. Is that the first time you attempted to do prose, or do you have a bunch of trunk novels?
So I spent a lot of my 20s writing abortive novels, writing failed novels. And they failed for a very good reason, which was that I did not know the first thing about story structure. My approach to writing a novel was write chapter one, have a cup of tea, come back, write chapter two, make another cup of tea, carry on until you get close to something that feels like an ending, and then write the end. So I was writing these like big shapeless bags of story. And I would send them up to publishers, and they would send me rejection letters along the lines of, you should try writing this as a novel.
Ouch.
And it was through writing comics that I kind of came face to face with my failings, you know, on that score. Because if you're writing a comic, a monthly comic or an episodic comic, you have a canvas that has a fixed size. You have a number of pages, and you can't go above and you can't go below. So you have to plot out the beats. You have to become a miser and count the pages and make sure that you don't run out of pages before you run out of story. So it focuses you in on structure in a very visceral way. And coming back out of that, trying to write novels again in my 40s, I guess it would have been, I kind of knew how to use the freedom that a novel form gives you. You know, the fact that the canvas is infinitely stretchable.
Yeah.
So I made a better fist of it second time around.
Well, and one of the things I would say too is that I feel like, and it's interesting that it happened when you were writing under a pen name, but you know, The Girl with All the Gifts seems like another leap, and we'll get there eventually, but I do want to talk about Felix Caster a little bit. But I first noticed the Felix Caster books as I was living in Portland at the time, and I remember it was like an impulse checkout at the library, because it was in the new releases, the first Felix Caster book, and I saw Mike Carey and instantly was like, hey, Hellblazer. he was one of the Hellblazer writers. And oh yeah, he wrote Lucifer. And, oh yeah, I'm definitely getting that book. And remember just being blown away with the fact that you were able to find something really different to do with kind of the supernatural kind of detective thing, or like exorcist thing, because it's close to Constantine, but you created this different character. And what I felt like, maybe I'm wrong, but it seemed like that was like a more comfortable place to write from when you're starting this new phase, was, you know, trying to do like a new spin on something similar to what you've done before.
Yeah, right? Yeah, very, very definitely. And I used Hellblazer as kind of a way to get my foot into that door.
Right.
Because it happened when I was still working on Hellblazer, and I sent a whole bunch of Hellblazers to Darren Nash, who was then in charge of the Orbit list, and I said, you know, I could write some novels that were in that space that were kind of like that but like a different take on that. And he was already aware of Hellblazer. I was already a big comics fan, and he commissioned 3 books, and in the end I wrote 5. So yeah, it was very much in the same space as Hellblazer. I guess in terms of style, it's borrowing in a fairly shameless way from Raymond Chandler. It's a noirish idiom that the books are written in.
Yeah. Well, and then that's interesting too, because with and you know, you had created a fan that by the time The Girl with All the Gifts came out, and again, I'm a big library guy, so I'm at the library and I see M.R. Carey, and I was like, well, I'm going to investigate because it's not the exact same name, but it has, and it had the sci-fi tag on it, which I know it's more horror, but it is kind of science, it is science fiction too.
Yeah,
it was in the sci-fi section. So I picked it up, looked at the author. And as soon as I saw that it was you, you know, I was like, okay, sold. And I read The Girl with All the Gifts totally cold. I did not read what the plot was. I did not read anything.
That's the best way to read it.
Yeah. And I appreciate authors that I trust, right? That I can go, because I did the same thing with Infinity Gate. And listen, I'm a no bullshitter. Not every book works for me. And that's one of the, I said that your Ramparts trilogy, and we can get into it, didn't work for me because of the prose style you were taking.
Right.
But one of the things that works, or what I think is so amazing about your work, especially post Girl with All the Gifts, and this starts with Girl with All the Gifts, is you take high concept, massive swings. And what I mean by that is that The Girl with All the Gifts, if you go into a cold and you really get the working of what the hell is going on, the first 7,500 pages is such a delightful mystery. But then when you realize what it's about, it is absolutely a completely original idea to an entire genre. And that's what's so impressive about, you know, most of the work that you've been doing in the last couple of years, almost all of it, M.R. Carey, right? Is that, in fact, I say all the time that I think what makes M.R. Carey distinct as a name is these massive high concept swings. And I don't know how you feel about me saying that, but that's what I think distincts them. And
it's
when
very
you set out to write The Girl with All the Gifts, was that the idea? Like, I'm gonna really try to do like an original zombie thing, because that's what it felt like to me.
So it's very kind of you to say, thank you. I think a lot of things came together in Girl with All the Gifts, and there's a reason why it came out under that pseudonym. But I'll address that in a moment. One of the things that had happened was that I wrote 2 novels as collaborations with my wife Linda and our daughter Louise. City of Silk and Steel, which was published in the US as Steel Seraglio, and House of War and Witness. So I'd spent 2 years, best part of 2 years, co-writing with 2 women who had very strong voices of their own. And with a collaboration, you kind of have to find a style that works for all of you. You have to sort of triangulate on a voice that everyone in the collaboration is, everyone in the team is comfortable with. And what that does, I think, is it sensitizes you to things, to what your default choices are. It makes you look more closely at things that you normally do without thinking about them at all. And it kind of made me, I came out on the other side of that more confident about experimenting with voice. So things like the fact that A Girl with All the Gifts is told in present tense, and the fact that it mostly consists of very short declarative sentences, which was my attempt to convey the vividness and immediacy of the way a child sees the world, because you're coming out into the world with Melanie. She's lived in a room, a suite of rooms all her life, and then suddenly she's out in the world. And I wanted the reader to get some of the impact of that. The other thing that had happened
by the way, is very challenging for hardcore writers, right? To get into.
Yeah.
And which was funny, because I remember my experience of reading it was that really challenged me as a reader, but I was so invested in the story at that point, it really was an interesting give and go as a reader, right? Because you're, and I think the same thing happened with later, the Stephen King novel, where the character grows up as the first person narrative.
Right.
Going on. It's very challenging. And my hat's off to you, because that is very hard to write, I'm sure.
It was, but it was also liberating, you know. After a sort of a period of acclimatizing, it was a gift that kept on giving. But the other thing that had happened, and it's happened to me a few times since, is that I started out with a short story. There was a short story called Iphigenia and Alice, which I wrote for an anthology. Charlene Harris and Tony Kellner used to do these themed anthologies every year. And the idea was they would come up with a really mundane everyday theme. Like one year it was family vacations, and another year it was home improvements. And the idea, the brief was to write a horror or dark fantasy or supernatural story that riffs on that theme. And the year that I said I would participate, the theme was school days. And having said I'd do it, I spent a long time staring at the wall, just coming up with really, really bad riffs on Harry Potter. And then I was in Bergen, I was in Norway for the Raptus Comic Convention, and I was in a hotel room that didn't have any heating. The heating had failed. So I spent a lot of time, when I wasn't on panels, I was cowering under three duvets in this bitterly cold hotel room. And the idea came to me while I was there of a little girl sitting in a classroom writing the essay that every child writes again and again during their school days, what I want to be when I grow up. And it's Melanie, you know, she has these fantasies, these ambitions, which are never going to be met because she's trapped in this institutional space. And I wrote the short story, sent it in, and then I kind of couldn't put the character down, couldn't put the world down. So I carried on playing with it, and what came out at the other end of that was Girl with All the Gifts. But I think the impetus to keep experimenting came from those collaborations with Lynn and Louise.
Which is, you know, and the final thing that came out of it was a book that just really didn't seem like anything we'd ever read before. And I think that's one of the reasons why it appealed to so many people, is because, you know, it became this kind of one of a kind apocalypse novel. And I want to get to Infinity Gate here pretty soon, but you had to, well, then, you know, the pen name M.R. Carey, this book that you write under a pen name, suddenly takes off as this massive hit. And so you're kind of stuck with the pen name, right?
Yep. Yes. And nobody's interested anymore in publishing Mike Carey. It's But Mike suffers from the comparison. What happened with the pen name was that I gave the manuscript to my editor in the UK, who was Anne Clark at that time, and she really liked it. But she thought it had the potential to appeal to a wider audience than the Caster books, which was what I was, you know, most associated with at that time. So they decided, as purely as a marketing thing, to give me a transparent pseudonym, so that buyers from the big chain bookstores and supermarkets looking at the book would not compare it with stuff I'd done before. They'd just buy it, they'd just make their decisions for orders on the book's own merits, which worked, which really worked. So they just said, we're gonna do an E&M Banks on you. We'll just publish the book under your initials. So what's your middle name? My middle name is James. So M.J. Carey. And the UK proofs went out under the name M.J. Carey. On the day that they were released, somebody at Orbit made a horrifying discovery, which was there was already an M.J. Carey on Goodreads, and she writes bondage pornography. And she is very prolific. And we felt that the title, The Girl with All the Gifts, took on a whole different set of connotations when you put it in that other context. So we switched very quickly to MR. And yeah, MR I've been ever since.
There's I can't avoid this Philip K. Dick story, but there was you know, he had that novel in the 60s, The Crack in Space, which happens to have a brothel in Orbit.
Right.
There's a really funny story about Terry Carr going down to Don Wolheim, who was the editor at Ace Books, you know, the first person to put science fiction on the cover of a book. And he said, "Don, we can't call this book Crack in Space." And he was like, "Why?" And Don Wolheim was like, "What are you talking about?" And he just turned around and laughed at it, stayed Crack in Space. It's kind of a funny, reminded me of that.
Yeah.
So she was a bondage, right? Well, you know, hey, now you're M.R. Carey, right?
Yeah, no, I'm M.R. Carey. Yep.
Yeah. Well, and so you've had several books under the name M.R. Carey. You did the sequel to The Girl with All the Gifts, The Boy and the Bridge, which was really, really great. And Fellside, the Ramparts trilogy. And just so I'm clear on it, you stuck to your guns on that with the prose, and that was the thing that I bounced off of with the Ramparts.
Okay.
And I admit that. And it's just because, and I totally respect what you did there, right? Because you committed to the concept, right?
Yeah.
And I super appreciate what you were doing there. I just had a very hard time reading the kind of future dialect of it. And I remember saying to somebody when I was reading it, I said, I'm bouncing off of it, but I so respect the commitment.
Did you give up in the end? Did you have to give up?
I finished reading it, but it was the first part of it was very hard for me. And
okay.
I respected, like I said, I'm a non-bullshitter. So what I want people to know is that when I tell people, and it sounds like hyperbole when I talk about The Girl with All the Gifts or Infinity Gate, I'm being dead honest. I'm not just blowing smoke. I love this stuff. Just as a reviewer, I have to tell people my honest opinion. I
Sure.
super respect what you were doing with Ramparts. I get it, but for people who don't know, it's kind of a post-societal thing, and so you wrote the prose with this kind of post-societal dialect, right?
Yeah.
At least that's and so it was so funny because I so respected that you stuck to it.
So the idea there was, you know, having a narrator who is barely literate, who's come to reading and writing quite late in life and is not good at it.
Right.
You know, he's particularly bad at irregular verbs. He doesn't know how to handle them. Some of the inspiration there came from Mark Twain. I was trying to do a kind of futuristic Huckleberry Finn.
Right. You
know, the wanderings of a young boy in a weird, dangerous world kind of thing.
Yeah. I respected your, I don't think if I tried, I could write a book like that. Even if somebody was like paying me tons of money, I would have a hard time writing a book like that. So I totally respect your effort on it, but that's one of the things that I'm saying I totally respect about what you do is the big swings, the big, huge swings. Because I don't think a lot of writers could do that. But anyways, to Infinity Gate, because I think this book is incredible. With Everything Everywhere All at Once and Spider-Verse and Star Trek doing multiverse and Marvel doing all that, doing a multidimensional story that is original or has something new to say, that's a challenge in itself. But by creating the scope that you did with the Pan-Dominion concept, I think that's what makes it so original or feel so different. Did you start with the concept and the world building, or did you have the character nugget like Melanie for Girl with All the Gifts to start this story?
I actually started with a map. And I'm not proud of this because generally speaking, I'm a little bit suspicious of stories that have lots and lots of maps at the front. I think more often than not, it's kind of a vanity thing rather than anything that's essential to the story. But I was watching a little YouTube documentary about the Schrödinger's cat paradox and the idea of quantum entanglement. And it was the presenter was talking about a new way of interpreting Schrödinger's cat thought experiment, which is, you know, in the classic form, you have the cat in the box, and there's a poison in the box that is either released or not released, and then until you open the box, the cat is both alive and dead, and then when you open the box, the quantum wave collapses, and the cat is either alive or it's dead. But there's another way of looking at it, which some quantum scientists now espouse, which is when you open the box, you become entangled, you become quantum entangled with the cat and with the contents of the box. So from that moment on, there's a universe in which you open the box and the cat is alive. And there's another universe where you open the box and go, oh, poor kitty. And both of those things are true. The universe is split up into two different states, and you're in both of them. And this just blew my mind. You know, true or false, it felt like a really bold and fascinating idea. And I started trying to draw a visual representation of a multiverse based on that kind of endless fractal branching. Did not get very far with it. But what came out of that was the idea of the Pandominion, the idea of an empire that was founded in fractal space, an empire in which there are a million worlds, but they're all variations on the same world. And then from that, I started to put the put characters in the landscape, Hades, and then Essien, Paz, Dulcie. So I started in a fairly abstract way, and then sort of fleshed out the story bit by bit. And it was hard, actually. It was one of the harder books to write that I've written. You know, Girl with All the Gifts came very fast, and there was only one substantial draft of it, and then minor revisions. There were five drafts of Infinity Gate, and they were structurally very different.
Yeah, I was talking to another writer friend of mine about, I was telling him about Infinity Gate, and I was saying, like, what an insane challenge this book seemed like, and how the fact that you pulled it off seemed like an absolute magic trick to me as an outside observer. Because, like I said, I went into it cold, so I started reading it with, I knew there was multiverse stuff from the tagline, the cover. But I didn't know anything. So the first 100 pages, I love a narrative sleight of hand, which is kind of what you do with the characters, because it seems like it's one character, and then it, and I don't want to give away too much what happens to that character, but, you know, this narrative sleight of hand is great. Now, one of the things that makes Infinity Gate franchise potential, like a Dune or a Game of Thrones, a Trek, or any of those war franchises, is that there's a vast and effective scope, in the sense of the Pandominium, you've created a galaxy. Because, and here's the thing, all your Klingons, your Borgs, or whatever you have in your version, they never have to leave Earth, right?
Yep.
And you can, and so when like the different villainous factions come in, you get to do all those things. You can have a universe as big in scope as the Federation and Romulans and Klingons, but they never have to leave Earth. It's genius. It's brilliant.
So somebody called it on Goodreads a space opera that never bothers to go into space.
Exactly. And I think that's so genius. I mean, like, there had to be a point where you realized, oh man, I could really do lots of different things here. And like the fact that within 500 or so pages, you're able to introduce all these ideas, that's part of the narrative magic trick. And I believe the bouncing from characters and the multiple point of views is one of the ways you had to do that, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's a point in the second book where one of the characters says that she feels like the little blind spot in the center of a kaleidoscope, that everything else keeps changing around her and she's the one fixed point. And that's kind of what I was doing with the structure, you know, just constantly turning the kaleidoscope around so that characters move from the background into the foreground, and the scope shifts and the settings shift. And there's even more of that in book two, because in book two you go into the insurrection, you meet the mother mass, so it goes sort of beyond the boundaries of the Pandominion into other parts of the multiverse.
Right. And what we do at this podcast is get under the hood of things. So I would hope at this point that people listening would have like trusted me and gone and gotten the book. But if you haven't, it might be a good time to pause, go read Infinity Gate, come back, because we might slip, let some things go. It's definitely either one or two of my top reads of the year. And I don't That's say cool. that lightly.
Thank you.
Because it's been a great year for science fiction. It really has been. But in this book, you get to comment on climate change, socio-political effects of militarism, colonialism, artificial intelligence, quantum physics, multiple worlds theory, biological and technological creation of life, and evolution. You got to do a lot here.
Yep. Yeah. all of them things that I'm an enthusiastic amateur about, rather than actually knowing anything very much. But yeah,
with all that, like, I mean, that kind of all flowed naturally out of the process of you just started with story and these things kind of came up, right?
Yeah.
And so there had to be a point where you were writing this where you were like, it had to feel a little bit like something that kept slipping out of your hands and you had to keep trying to catch it, right?
Very much so. I mean, this is why it went through so many drafts. There was a point where I showed it to Anna, my current UK editor, when it was about maybe 45,000 words in. I just showed it to her as a work in progress and said, you know, this is what I'm doing. Is it okay? And she was very enthusiastic, but she wanted me to, she said, the structure is really weird, the way you keep jumping around. Is there a way of doing it so that the characters are more kind of organically interwoven? And so I started trying to unpick the story so that Paz comes in earlier, so that Essien comes in earlier. And it didn't work. It really didn't work. And the other thing that didn't work was there's a crucial thing that happens in Hadiza's arc quite early on, which doesn't get resolved until the very end of the book. And Anna wanted me to handle that in a different way. And the more I tried to wrangle it into a more conventional shape, the more it disintegrated. And I reached a point, this would have been like early 2002. I reached a point where I just couldn't do it anymore. I had this book that had like exploded and broken into fragments, and I just put it aside. I thought, right, that's it. It's a failure. And I started writing something completely different, which is a take on the Magnificent Seven or the Seven Samurai, if the Seven Samurai were undead monsters, set in the Middle Ages in the UK. It's got ghosts and zombies and witches and bogeymen and so on, and it was crazy fun, and it was really quick. I wrote it in like 3 months, and it was restorative. I came out on the other side of that, and I thought, okay, I can go back to Infinity Gate now and see what works and what doesn't work. You know, I got enough of a distance from it. I went back and I laboriously started putting it together again, and this time it clicked. It actually sort of held together.
Yeah, the structure really works well. One of the things is that it could be easy in a structure like this to be like wondering where the characters went to, you know, because,
yeah.
But the thing is that the characters are so well written that you get hooked immediately into, you know, wherever the action shifts, because characters like
Hadiz,
yeah, and Paz, who, by the way, is as a rabbit dad with five. Now we just got a fifth rabbit in our house yesterday.
Cool.
you know, having a main character rabbit doesn't hurt. You know, I mean, coming from a rabbit earth, that's pretty cool. But Hadiz also, in that initial story, one of the things that's cool as a serious dickhead here, you did the Man in the High Castle trick where everyone assumes that, I think, that this world that she's in is our world, right? And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that the world inside the novel of Man in the High Castle has lots of differences. The Allies won, but they didn't win the same way as they did in our world. And I think one of the cool things that Phil did in that book was to, you know, immediately suggest, like, hey, just because this is another, you know, it's not just one universe, two universes. And very quickly, Hadiz's story suggests to us that there's a wider universe. And for me, as somebody who read it cold, you know, the way that is unfolded is excellent.
Very well. Thank you.
Yeah,
I had a lot of fun creating the characters. You mentioned Paz, and the cool thing about Paz is that she's very, very easy to underestimate. She comes across as like incredibly naive, incredibly trusting, and kind of helpless in the face of this gigantic sort of ungovernable universe. And then basically, you know, her strand is the story of somebody starting to come to terms with that and starting to assert their own agency and to take control. That's a point where it feels like it's impossible for her to do that. I think she's my favorite character of the three main protagonists.
And one of the things that's cool about Paz being a rabbit, right, and is that, you know, a lot of, it's funny because some books you read, you're like, you see the movie in your mind right away. And one of the things I love about Infinity Gate is I constantly was like, they couldn't do this. this is a book. Yes, they probably could do it as a movie or a TV show if they tried. But I love that it lives as like kind of a prose monster, if you know what I mean. Like, mm-hmm. this, yeah. And but then again, I didn't really see how you were going to do The Girl with All the Gifts, and you specifically did it by writing the screenplay, right?
At the same time, as I was writing the novel, yeah.
Yeah.
That really helped, actually, so the fact that I was bouncing between two different versions of the story.
Wow, yeah. And how lucky were you to get Glenn Close and all that?
I still can't believe it. When Cammy, the producer, phoned me and said, Glenn said yes. Yeah. Glenn Close is going to speak my lines. My God.
That was awesome. But back to Infinity Gate. So, so Paz and these alternative evolutions give the book a surreal quality that make it, like, you know, very different. Like, how much fun did you have doing the surreal stuff? And did you dial that back, or did you just go full bore on it?
No, I leaned into it. I mean, it's not just Paz, it's Moon Sustenti as well, the cat warrior, who gets to come much more into the fore in the second book. The idea of these alternate lines of evolution and the societies that they would produce, and the kind of mistrust. There's a version of what's the Disney movie, Zootropolis? You know, the sort of Zootopia, the natural mistrust between carnivores and herbivores, and the tendency of carnivores to think of herbivore cultures as inferior. So that there's a the relationship between Paz and Moon is problematic from the start and continues to be so through the second book. But eventually they kind of come to an understanding with each other. So I loved all that. And I loved the fact that, you know, the way the story plays out allows me to sort of mess around with infinite variations on those things. It's only a duology that the two novels sort of wrap up as a story. It's not open-ended at all, but I'm currently working on a novel which is set against the backdrop of the Pandemonium. So it's kind of like a fable of the Pandemonium, or a legend of the Pandemonium, because it is a it's a really nice canvas to have to play with.
Well, certainly, I think you could do 100,000 stories in any of it.
I should live so long.
Yeah.
We maybe three or four.
Well, but you know, I'm sure when Gene Roddenberry created Star Trek, he didn't realize how many stories were going to come out of that, right?
Yeah. So,
and right now, this is your canvas. So, but my thinking on this is that scope of the universe that you've created, you know, I think as long as your imagination is firing, I'm sure ideas are gonna pop up here and there in the future.
I hope so.
And let's hope the readers discover or you know want as many as I do. Right.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Now there's a quote I'm just gonna read. But the Pandominion wasn't made overnight and didn't come without a cost. The first few parallel worlds learned how to step, wounded and wasted each other in endless, unwinnable wars, wars that were nothing but onslaught, since stepping made every square foot of ground a battlefront, until they finally came to see that infinity made war obsolete. You must have really thought out that history, right? They had to, right?
Yep.
So see, yep, their stories right there. Right.
In book two, we meet Spearhead Division, which is the branch of the cello that does kind of first contact, that goes out and discovers. I mean, they're specifically looking for potential threats to the Pandominion, not so much for worlds to conquer as worlds that might actually be too dangerous to go near to approach. And there is a Spearhead that discovered the Mother Mass, you know, this sentient planet. So all of that sort of all of that history comes back in the second book.
Yeah, and the Mother Mass, by the way, you know, it's awesome because, and I don't mean this to be reductive, because I mean this as an absolute compliment, but it's like your Borg, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Because I love what a science fiction universe, you could say, oh, that's kind of their Klingons or that's their Romulans or whatever, you know, because I think I love the power chords of space opera, right? Because there's
Me
certain
too.
Elements that are the power chords. And if you play a power chord really well, you've got a great backbeat. And what I love about the Mother Mass, for example, is like they're immediately understandable as a villain. As an antagonist, you get it right away. As soon as they're introduced, you see all their potential. And as a person who likes their imagination stoked by a book, I like when a book makes me start thinking like, oh, you could do this, you could do that, there's this great thing. And the Mother Mass was a moment where my mind just started firing. And I was like, ready. I was ready for you to go there. And so then when the insurrection is brought in, I'm like, yep, yeah. We're there. We got it. You know, we got the stuff I wanted. And so, and one of the things that makes me feel really good about that as a reader is that that's one of those moments where you're like, yeah, I'm in great hands. Like this is telling me a story that I feel really good about, because it's doing both big swings that I couldn't see coming and things that just make perfect sense and are just great. Just chef's kiss. And I think the Mother Mass chef's kiss. Now where did that come into the process? How early was that part of
that map that I did right at the outset? It was a map. The center of it was a kind of enfolding spiral in different colors, and that was meant to represent the opening of a sort of fractal flower of different universes. And then there were four blocks that were outside it. So like four rectangular spaces at the four corners of the map, and one of them was the Mother Mass, one of them was a kind of an orbital civilization that moved between the sort of outer planets of the different solar systems, and I can't remember now what the other two were, but the Mother Mass was, one of them was the Scour world, the empty worlds. So the mother mass was in there from the start, but I didn't decide from the start that that it would become a character. That that happened in a more organic way, as the story I was telling in the story. The mother mass is much more present in the second book.
Now, did you keep the map visible when you were writing?
Yeah, or, I went and looked at it every now and again just for inspiration's sake. And I don't know where it is now. I do this stupid thing, which is if I have loose sheets of paper, I slip them into the front of books, usually graphic novels. And I've got hundreds and hundreds of graphic novels. So the map is there somewhere, but I can't immediately put my hand on it.
Yeah, I did a map for a science fiction novel I co-wrote with a friend called Flesh Trade, where we had like this kind of new Bangkok type, like fucked up city on another planet. And it was funny because I knew the map was only just for us, but I had made a copy for Ed. And then when I was writing, like the having the geography of it right there was really helpful. I didn't really feel like anybody needed to see it. And I think with what you're doing, like that map is something, it sounds like something that you would need, right? To keep everything straight. But it's all very clear in the book. It works really, really well. And it's funny because I'll admit, Mike, when I was like about halfway through this book, I was like, oh, this shit's going to get confusing. This is going to get really confusing. And it did. It was all very clear. And I remember I read the last 100 pages. I was on the train, on the trolley here, like in San Diego, going to the SDSU library. And I almost missed my stop because the ending was so good. I almost ended up on the trolley for much longer than I needed to be. And I remember thinking on that last, like, holy shit, it all works. It all came together because I really thought it was going to be much more confusing than it was.
It kind of narrows to a point, doesn't it? It starts out in a lot of different places, but it's a convergence. The structure is a convergence.
Yeah. And so are we going to, so last thing on Infinity Gate, and I'm going to try to wrap up here. You've given me a lot of your time, and I really appreciate this.
Yes, pleasure.
The second book, you've already finished the second book. And you've started this kind of fable. So you got a third adjacent story for Infinity Gate. Okay, cool. And our Seven Samurai Middle Ages book, is that coming?
That's coming. So next year, in I think maybe May or June, Echo of Worlds, which is the second Panamanian novel. And then nothing for the rest of 2024. Into 2025, I Will Tell You Seven, which is this this weird kind of supernatural story. And then maybe late 2025, Dog Bitch Bess, which is this the fable.
Okay. And so again, what's the title of the second Infinity Gate?
Echo of Worlds.
Echo of Worlds. All right. Well, I'm very excited for that one. I would personally, I mean, Girl with All the Gifts is a pretty impressive piece of horror sci-fi fiction crossover. I would feel like you got to be pretty proud of this one, right?
I am. I really am.
Yeah.
Really, really happy with how it came together because it was a hard, hard journey.
Yeah. And yeah, because I mean, and when I talk about taking daring swings, like this had to feel like, you know, not to stretch the baseball metaphor too far, but it had to feel like closing your eyes and swinging, right?
Yeah. It actually felt like I was trying to do a jigsaw in the dark at times.
Right. Well,
different metaphor.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it really, really, really worked. So I think if as far as like, so you said this is closed, two books, it's not a trilogy then. Okay.
Nope.
Interesting. Yeah. And so we've got a handle on where you're going with all this. So we have a closed ending for Infinity Gate.
yes,
for this story. Got it.
But then probably returning, well, certainly returning to the Pandemonium as an idea in other books.
Okay. But these characters, this particular storyline has a clear end, which
that wraps up.
Yeah, that's important because I think with a story like this, it could be easily like, go everywhere.
Some reviewers were not happy with the cliffhanger ending of Infinity Gate. They felt that it was a little bit of a false prospectus. But I didn't want to end it on a false resolution. I wanted to sort of to end it on here they are, the team has come together, and this is the crisis they're now facing, and that's the story of the second book.
Well, I think it's a perfect ending for what's introduced at the beginning, you know, kind of the reveal at the end. It's funny too, because I definitely had the thought of when I was reading the last dwindling pages, like, whoa, this is going to end really soon.
Yep. And really then, suddenly.
Yeah. And, but I was pleased with, where it went. Mike, I don't say this lightly. This is a masterpiece of science fiction. And
Thank you, David.
In 2023, when we are coming up on the 100th centennial of science fiction as a genre with a name, we know science fiction has existed longer than the 100 years. But as a genre with a name, it is hard to come up with truly original science fiction. And the thing I struggle with when I'm trying to rank my favorite reads of the year is The Mountain in the Sea, Ray Naylor. This is your competition for the top spot. That book really changed how I viewed the world. And that's
okay.
Like
I have to read it.
Yeah, it was hugely influential in that way. But I've read Solaris, and I've read things that were similar to it. And what really got me with Infinity Gate was doing a multiverse story where I feel like I've never seen anything like this before. That in 100 years of science fiction, you've done something original. That's a freaking magic trick, sir. That is a magic trick. And I half the reason I wanted to have you on the podcast was just to tell you with my mouth words how much I love this book.
That is very cool. It's a lovely thing to hear.
It's one thing to type it, but it's another thing to say, like, holy shit, I loved this book. And I did love Infinity Gate. So I hope everyone gets out there and gets it. Is there other work of yours that you feel has been missed that you want to put a plug out for, whether it's the comics or whether it's some of the older books?
Well, there's a new Felix Caster story that came out this year, The Ghost in Bone, which was a novella that I did for Subterranean, and it was really fun to go back into that world.
I did not know about this. See, like, I needed to know this.
It is a limited edition hardcover. It's it follows on a couple of years after the end of Naming of the Beasts, and it moves forward the sort of big arc story of why are the dead rising, what was the great project in hell. I'd love to plug the two novels that I wrote with Lou and Lynn, City of Silk and Steel and Steel Surrender, and House of War and Witness. House of War and Witness. It's a historical ghost story.
I have not read those, and they sound awesome. And I admit I did not know of those. Now I they will be on my list, sir.
So. Cool. And also there's a comic I wrote a long, long time ago, called My Faith in Frankie. It was a 4-issue miniseries, and it's the only time I've ever attempted comedy. Specifically romantic comedy, and I had great fun with it. The art was by Sonny Liu and Mark Hempel, and it's a gorgeous book. And there was a soft cover collection of it a little while ago, which you can probably pick up on eBay for a couple of dollars. And I think it's one of the things I'm most proud of.
Well, sir, I appreciate your time and coming on Postcards from Dying World. You're welcome anytime. I'm
Thank you.
sure when you write this sequel, I'll be ringing you up. Or when the sequel comes out, I'm really looking forward to it. I just love getting under the hood with writers, and I love hearing about your process, because I definitely, when I was reading this book, thought, what the hell is this guy doing? he is working on another level, because I just was so impressed by what you were able to pull off of this book.
Thank you, David. It's been a great pleasure talking.
Yeah, and so folks, if you haven't read all the M.R. Carey, definitely do that. I imagine if you got to this point, you read Infinity Gate. I've been singing the praises for it, but the whole back catalog is pretty amazing, and I just really love Mike's work, so I appreciate that. I'm excited to know there's more Felix Caster. I did not know that, so Subterranean, I'm on it. And folks, thanks for listening, and just remember, StokerCon coming up this year in San Diego. We'll be doing all kinds of events here in San Diego to promote StokerCon coming, so we can pregame. We're going to have monthly events leading up to it, and the World Horror Writers Convention here in San Diego. It's a great reason to come here and visit us. And we'll see folks also at the PKD Festival in Colorado next summer. So thank you everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.